Hey, everybody, and welcome to Prioritizing, a married couple's faith-based insight into what is most important in education, in life, and in marriage. And we are that married couple. I am Michael Pryor, joined by my much better half, Samantha. Hey, Samantha, how are you, sweetie?
Good. How are you doing, Michael?
I am just peachy. Samantha is an absolute doll. Look at her over there. Samantha and I have been married for 2 years. We have a lot of different interests, and a lot of people will tell you you need to have a lot in common, that opposites don't attract, they'll say. But Samantha and I, we don't do a lot of activities together. Within the household, we do everything together. But as far as extracurriculars, I like my sports. She likes crafty stuff. She's a half marathon runner, this, that, and the other. But we don't have anything that we share. So we thought this would be a perfect opportunity to do something together. Isn't that right, Samantha?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So we're going to dive right in. What we're going to touch on a lot is has to do, like we mentioned, is education. We're both educators. But before I get any deeper into the introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Samantha. Samantha, start with the introductions, would you, sweetie?
So coming out of the blue corner, we have at 155 pounds, 29 years old and just shy of 6 feet, Michael Pryor, who is a man of many talents. He captures his audience through singing Frank Sinatra, as well as riding his unicycle, juggling, playing football, softball, dodgeball, any sport out there, and above all else is a professional boxer.
And in the red corner, weighing in at, can I say this on the air? I probably can't say that on the air. I'll skip that part. Weighing in at, we'll beep this part out. Age, I can't say that either, can I? Nope. You'll learn a few things when you get married. But anyway, back to the beginning. In the red corner, her name is Samantha Pryor. Her hobbies include scrapbooking, running road races, her aspirations are to one day work in the Catholic schools office, perhaps, or be a curriculum developer. And she is currently a fifth grade teacher at St. Bernadette Elementary School in Silver Spring, Maryland. So those are our introductions. Now, the boxing analogy, as you heard Samantha say, that I do box professionally, and that's why we use the red corner and blue corner analogies. Those, and that doesn't reflect the married couple stigma about fighting. I just want to be clear about that. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, fights are going to happen. You know, they don't need to happen. It's all up to you. And if I had one piece of advice that I'd give to young married couples out there, I would say that with an abundance of faith and love mixed with a healthy dose of mercy and compromise, your marriage has all of the ingredients needed to be everlasting. How about you, Samantha? You got any good pointers for our married couples out there?
I do. I think marriage can sometimes be tough, particularly in how to communicate with one another. And I know for me, that's been the biggest struggle, is figuring out what you need above what I need. And my biggest piece of advice would be to all the people out there to continue to communicate, share what you're thinking and feeling, with maintaining that support and utmost love for your husband or wife.
That's pretty sound advice, Samantha. You mentioned communicating. We both mentioned communicating, in fact. So we're giving you a little bit of an insight into our marriage, but we won't talk about the specifics of our marriage too often. We'll probably just give you some generalizations. And those generalizations are from experiences, so you can draw your own conclusions that they are about us. But anyway, let's dive into our first topic. Today we're going to talk a bit about, since we're both educators, Samantha, fifth grade teacher, assistant principal in Chantilly, Virginia. It's my first year doing so, and I absolutely love it. We're going to talk about prepping for the school year. Okay, prepping for those first days of school before the students even come into your classroom. How are you getting ready? What are you doing? Who are you speaking with to get a better idea of what students are going to be walking through your door before the school year begins? Now, Samantha, I want to touch on something. I'm going to let you rattle off a bit about this.
Okay.
Summer's off. Teachers have summers off. Everyone wants to be a teacher because we have summers off. Talk a bit about that, would you please?
Summer is a great opportunity to prepare for the next school year. As teachers, many of us look forward to our new lesson plans, implementing changes that we're excited about in that fresh beginning. So teachers having summers off isn't the truth for so many of us. Our days are spent thinking about the kids that are going to walk in our classroom door, the environment that we want to establish for them, how we want them to feel, as well as the curriculum and what lesson plans we want to do, what units of study we might be excited for, how we're going to manage behaviors, setting up the rooms for each of those students so that we reach every child and not just an overall class.
So what you're pretty much saying is that it's a fallacy. Teachers do not have summers off. The good ones, at least, do not.
Yeah, many of us do not.
Yes, because that's, you know, it's 2 months off. You know, I'm making the quote signs right now. You can't see them. But it's 2 months off, but it's a prime opportunity to prep. I mean, middle school teachers, I'm sure, can attest to this as well. That free period is so precious because you get to prep for what's coming, whether it's next week's plans, next month's unit, whatever you're prepping for, it's time is so crucial. So to a teacher, to have that time off, sure, we're going to take a vacation with the family, they're going to do a lot of fun things, but I can't think of more time that would go to waste for a teacher to do little to no school-related work over the summer. And I haven't met one that truly doesn't do anything over the summer. They'd have to be pretty bold to come back the week before school in August and expect it is jump right in and have everything planned for the first week. And it's a lot of work. There's a lot of prep time. Making bulletin boards, that is absolutely brutal. And Ron Clark, and you know, he's a name I'm going to bring up quite a bit on this podcast. I had the privilege of seeing him in Virginia earlier in the year, and he actually doesn't make his teachers do bulletin boards. They don't do bulletin boards in the hallway. They don't hang student work because he says it takes away from their time in the classroom to prep for what's really important. So it's a pretty good point. Not many schools have adopted that because the bulletin boards are flashy. The kids look forward to it. Some of them, especially when they're interactive and kids can actually go up to the bulletin board and put their own accomplishments up there, very positive.
Well, and I think too, Michael, that going back to that timepiece and having not enough time during the school year. You know, many teachers show up hours before the kids arrive and stay well past they leave. It's not your 9-to-5 job where you walk home and you can cook dinner and spend time with your family and it's just relaxing. For many of us teachers, we're thinking about things that happen that day, thinking about the problems that the students are having. So that summer time and that having that few extra hours a day to prep and establish how you want your classroom to go the next year is so crucial because you don't have that time during the school year. So many more important things steal that time from you.
Absolutely. You mentioned something, too, I had written down. When you go home at night and you're eating dinner and you're having dinner with your families or what have you, a lot of people are thinking, you know, can go home and just, it's a fresh slate, new day tomorrow. And that's certainly the case for teachers. But if there are things that go wrong during the school day, if a student has a meltdown or if a lesson didn't go well, I can guarantee you that most teachers, that's all they're thinking about until they get a chance to redeem themselves or correct the behavior or the situation. So it's a 24-hour job, truly. I mean, I can think of the worst nightmares I've had in August, the weeks before school, is I go to sleep and it's me at school the first day and I have nothing prepared, there are no bulletin boards up, and it's just me. Because that's every teacher's worst nightmare, is being thrown into a situation where you're not prepared. But luckily, we are given that time off to make sure we are prepared for the next school year and that we're well rested and our batteries are recharged, but we can recharge our batteries while still preparing. Samantha, I want to ask you, you had mentioned getting ready for the next students that come in for the next school year. How much creed do you take in, creed, is that the word? How much creed? Credence? I don't know if that's the word. Anyway, how much do you take the previous teacher's word when speaking about a specific student? Let's say little Johnny. Gotta watch out for Johnny. He's a troublemaker. He's coming in. I know you're smiling because you've had that happen. And I've had that happen. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think you just have to take everything with a grain of salt. It's always good to talk to the teachers from years past and ask what the strengths and weaknesses of each student is, that way you're able to gain some background and a foundation to establish your relationship with that child. However, you can't take it as gold. You know, there's been so many instances where kids have different things going on in their lives. You don't know the reasons for those behaviors, and they're walking into your classroom as a completely fresh start. They have no idea what the year is going to be like. They're going to be nervous. So I know for me, I always start my class off on the very first day talking about how they have a choice to be whoever they want to be, that I don't care about their past. I don't care if they didn't do their homework or if they had behavior problems, that right now they have a fresh start and they get to show me the choices that they want to make. And being 10 and 11 years old in fifth grade, they're a little bit more mature to do so. And they know, and they still, some of them feel haunted by decisions that they've made in the past. And they have that reputation like, oh, I'm just a troubled kid, or I stink at reading. Whereas it's proven to be a good stepping stone for them to really work and establish the goals that they have for this coming year, and know that the possibilities are open to whatever it is they want to achieve.
Great. Now, to speak to that, if I could, you mentioned, easy, Samantha, you're doing fine. to speak to that, if I could, you had mentioned a new fresh slate. Now, I know we're talking about the beginning of the school year, so forgive me for getting off on a tangent, but it is relevant. Let's say you have that same little Johnny. He's caught cheating on a test or what have you. And on Tuesday, at the end of the day, Tuesday, he has a meltdown and everything, blah, blah, blah. He comes in on Wednesday. Is that Wednesday another opportunity for a fresh start, Samantha?
Oh, certainly. And I think greeting your students every day with a smile is so important. And waiting for them at the door and taking that time to speak to each of them individually. Because we know as teachers that there's always going to be the kids that take up more of our time, for whatever reasons it might be in that particular year. But it's really hard to make sure that every student feels valued and every student feels like, oh yeah, Mrs. Pryor is talking to me, without thinking, oh, well, her attention is busy with some other kid.
That value is so important, because kids in general are so eager to please. And when they wrong somebody, it weighs on their minds pretty heavily. So even the smallest, you know, after you scold the kid, if you pop them a smile later, you say, I like the way you're turning your day around, that can go such a long way with a student, you know, from grades K to 12, I'm sure. Not that they're fragile emotionally, but they need that constant building up. And there's no reason for us teachers not to do that, because, grudges in the first place are not good to have in your daily life or in marriage. As Samantha and I, she's smiling right now. But in education, you gotta have a short memory and give the students an opportunity to turn their day around, or to turn their week around, or whatever, or what have you. Or if you have a really troubled student, to turn their year around. We can't harp on what's happened in the past. We gotta give them a chance every single day when they walk into our classroom to be the best version of themselves. Go ahead.
Sorry. I agree. And I think, too, as teachers, we know that we're not just teaching content. It's not just math or reading. We're really teaching them the skills that they need to be good citizens and to solve problems socially, to make new friends, to find commonalities between people that they might disagree with. Because those are, when they're adults in the workplace later, they're going to need to know how to deal with problems, how to talk respectfully. So a lot of that planning over the summertime and that positive reinforcement that you're talking about, and whether it be a tap on the shoulder or that praise, that positivity, and letting them see that, oh, you know, I can do this, I can handle this, just helps them see the whole person and the whole child of who they want to be.
There's two things you touched on, Samantha, that I want to kind of build off of. You mentioned the social aspect of schooling and how students are going to become eventually better citizens. Shout out to my junior achievement class that I teach. I teach a sixth grade elective and I get to teach junior achievement. And before they come into my classroom, they have to give me a look in the eye, a handshake, and a good afternoon. And you know what's, it's so funny. Some of them still, as they come in, we know we're only 5 or 6 days into the class, but they are so uncomfortable. They laugh. They give me the limp handshake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on it because those skills are so important, and I think they're so absent in a lot of our youth. Even guys and gals my age, I think, don't have that social foundation, and it's so missing. And I'm going to touch it. And the other thing I wanted to touch on was you mentioned we're prepping them to be better citizens, but we're also prepping them to be faithful stewards of Christ. And that's why Catholic education, and we're going to talk a whole nother episode about Catholic versus public education, because both of us have also taught in public education, and we're going to kind of compare and contrast. But we have the privilege and the responsibility as Catholic educators to not only prep them for adulthood and citizenship, but for heaven. Our main goal as teachers and as future parents are to get our students and children to heaven. And whatever we can do to get them there, we will do. And if that means giving them a fresh start every day, then so be it. We will do that. Okay, so let's talk about new students who are coming to school. Now, you teach fifth grade. I used to teach second grade. So the kids are a bit more resilient. They meet somebody new on the playground. They can be buddies in 2 minutes, and they can be enemies in 2 minutes after that. But in fifth grade, friendships have been established. Groups have been established. Cliques, in some cases, sadly, have been established. How do you get a new student from an entirely new school acclimated with the student body that they're unfamiliar with?
Well, I think, too, it just goes back to that planning and preparation. This could essentially be a episode or podcast of its own, because establishing your classroom community starting off the year is so essential. Many teachers will rush into the content, and they skip over those routines, and it's so important. In fifth grade, you know, 10 and 11 years old, some of them 9 coming in August, they're kids, but they have a foot in the teenage adult world. They want to be independent. They're exposed to music, movies that maybe are beyond their years, and that they don't fully understand the different concepts or the use of language that they hear. So those cliques can sometimes be based off of their interests and things that they see in outside of their school life. So with kids coming in September, August, and new to the school, it's so important that each year is started as a fresh start for every kid. I don't care who you're friends with, together in this classroom, we support one another. You don't have to be best friends with everyone, but you do have to talk with kindness. You do have to try to make an effort to get to know them as a human being for who they are now. So that can be done through different activities that you do and taking that time as a whole class to build those relationships that each kid can start off reflecting back on, oh yeah, that was really fun, or that made me really happy, or I learned this about someone that I didn't realize I had in common.
Right. And the one thing you mentioned, Samantha, was supporting. We all support each other. We don't have to be best friends. I think especially when you get to your age group, 10, 11, 12, they're past that whole everyone's got to be friends. We all are buddies. We're all best friends. So as long as you're encouraging, I mean, of course, in an ideal world, we want everyone to be friends. We want everyone to love each other. But realistically speaking, that's not going to happen. But as long as there is a mutual respect for each other and that support, I think your classroom will run much more efficiently. Is that safe to say, Samantha?
Yeah, I completely agree. And the age of your students depends on how you're going to handle those situations.
Mm-hmm.
As a second grade teacher, you might not necessarily take that approach. But by the time that they get to fifth grade, you know, they are young adults, and it's important to treat them that way too, and to level with them and choose your battles essentially. And I'd rather have them talk kind to one another,
right,
and learn how to handle their anger and their stress and their frustration and apply those coping skills rather than explode and just paint this fairy tale picture like everyone's going to get along, you'll be fine.
Mm.
That's not always the case.
I don't know the classroom would end up if that was the fifth grade or sixth grade teacher painting that picture. There are some that can get away with that. They just have that presence about them. I'm thinking of Mr. Lee's one of those people. Mr. Lee from St. Bernadette. Shout out to Mr. Lee. He just has that calming presence that he doesn't need to raise his voice, and he can just keep everyone at peace, at least on the surface. They at least look like they're at peace. They might be thinking about other things and daydreaming and doing other things. I used to tell my students on the way to Mass, you know, I'd encourage them in second grade to, you know, they're receiving their first Holy Communion and getting their important sacraments that year. I would encourage them strongly to listen to the gospel and the readings, and we talk about it when we got back to class. I want to be realistic at the same time. If I have a squirmer who's, they don't go to Mass on Sundays, and they're just, it's very challenging for them to sit still for a whole hour. Usually I'll sit them next to me, and then my only goal for them is to at least look like you are paying attention.
Well, Michael, you bring up a good point, is especially nowadays, I think there's more and more students coming through our classrooms that are not Catholic, and finding a way to level and explain and teach.
But that's okay, right?
Yeah, no, it's totally fine. And it's just a greater opportunity for us to try to spread the word of God to people who might not be familiar. And you might have kids coming in that know a little bit or don't understand. And
sure,
that's just another opportunity to help spread the values that we're so focused on instilling in these kids.
And I think that's often overlooked by teachers, especially when you go into Mass. They think, I've seen teachers that'll let the non-Catholic students with it sit and not participate, not go up for communion. Now, of course, they can't receive communion, but they'll still go up for a blessing. They'll put their arms across the chest, you know, like the make the X. But a lot, some teachers will actually allow their non-Catholic students to sit. But I think definite way to keep them uninterested in the faith. If you get them up and moving and engaged, and we'll talk about engagement in another episode, but getting them interested in what the priest is talking about, to what the Monsignor is talking about, to the process and what the body of Christ actually means and symbolizes, I think that's a great opportunity for evangelization. And too many teachers, I think, are passing up that opportunity because they're just saying, they're not Catholic, they're not going to convert. They might not convert because of you personally, but you have that opportunity to nudge them in the right direction, we'll say. Yeah, I'll say right direction because it is the right direction, I believe.
And kids, no matter what age, are very perceptive. They're picking up on things. So as teachers, it's important for us to lead by example. And if we're singing and we're participating, you know better than anyone, but I'm not a talented singer. It is not something that comes naturally.
She is telling the truth here, folks.
But that's one thing. I'm always singing at Mass with my class. I can't expect them to do it if I'm not willing to do it myself.
Sure.
And I think setting that example first and foremost in our own actions sticks with the kids. And that's something that even after they leave your classroom or my classroom, I hope that they'll remember and they'll retain those behaviors that just seem second nature, even though they might not be. I know that I have a lot of thought into my actions and reasons for why I'm doing what I'm doing. But to the kids, I do hope that they seem normal and just that second nature.
Right. Now, going back to the new student in the classroom, I know we're kind of bouncing around here, but all these topics really are intertwined. When you have the new student, I mean, I'm sure now when I was teaching, when I was in the classroom, I'd make it a point to reach out to the parents before the year began. Whether it's a week or a couple weeks ahead of time, just kind of introducing myself. And I do this just through an email. I know, and here's Ron Clark again. Ron Clark used to actually visit every home of the students in his school just to get to know the parents on an individual basis, and which I think is absolutely terrific and good for him because, you know, we're fortunate enough to live in and teach in suburban neighborhoods where Ron Clark is from Atlanta, Georgia. And it's not the nicest of neighborhoods, most affluent, I should say. So he'd want to introduce himself on a personal level and get to know the kids and the parents beforehand. And now, Samantha, I'm going to ask you, for new students, do you make it a point to reach out to them ahead of school? Do you reach out to the entire class? What do you do?
Well, every student is new when they come into your classroom. Well, maybe you've taught siblings before. You've never had that child in your classroom before. And I love the idea of reaching out to the families beforehand, either through a welcome letter, a video, a postcard. Visiting the homes is great. And for many of those families who do come from a more challenging social situation or living situation, the parents themselves probably don't have a good association of the school. or good memories from when they were in school. So if you have someone who feels comfortable and is willing to meet them on their turf, you could say, it just forms that positive relationship right off the bat. So it's important to reach out to every kid. And I think going a little bit further with students that are new to the school and new to the community is important, because it's up to us to help them find those support systems in their class and in with neighboring families to help them be successful in this new environment.
Absolutely. Getting them in, getting them acclimated, comfortable, that's the whole deal. You know, anything that we can get them a step ahead, because they're essentially, especially the ones who are new to the school entirely, they're a step behind as far as socially and meaning socially. They don't have those groups, those peers to lean on, so they might be a little less comfortable coming in. So if we get them, what I would do is actually, for one student last year, I actually brought her into the classroom before the year began, just to make sure she was comfortable on day one coming in. She was a step ahead. She knew what everything was. She knew my behavior system, my classroom management system. She knew where her desk was. She knew all the kids' names. So it was good for her to, you know, take that sigh of relief before the school year even began. So it kind of caught her up.
And that's where communicating with your colleagues is so important, so that you can know the needs of the students a little bit before they come in. I'm sure that without having any background knowledge about the student, you wouldn't have known that she would have felt more comfortable or she could have benefited from that. So, I mean, it goes back to that idea of take it with a grain of salt, but still use your colleagues as a resource, so that every student is starting off that first day with kind of a leg up. They know that you know a little bit about them, and you have a starting point to get to know them better.
That was actually one thing I was just about to mention and ask you about, was on the social side of things, you know, you don't just want to take the teacher's word that this kid's rotten or this kid's the greatest kid in the world, or, and hopefully they're not using those words. But there are instances, like you mentioned, you know, students with learning needs, with social needs in the classroom, with attention needs. Attentional, is that even a word? Attentional?
Attention?
I don't know. Anyway, attention needs, those are pivotal to the structure and the flow, that's the word, the flow of your classroom. So that information is really important to get before the year begins, and hopefully your schools have level meetings or PLCs, professional learning communities, that meet on a regular basis that discuss these students, not on a griping level, but on a needs-based level, so that any teacher who receives the student has kind of an idea ahead of time of what to expect and how to make their education most beneficial to them, despite their learning needs or social needs.
And one of the most powerful resources that you have as a teacher is your colleagues, because they've been through it before too. You know, they maybe not even a kid in your class, but have had a similar experience. But you bring up a good point, not letting it spiral into the gossip or the venting, but rather not even saying that a child's name, but just expressing, you know, I have this situation, you know, XYZ is going on. What do you suggest? Or do you have any experiences or strategies? Because the ultimate goal is to meet the needs of these kids and to support them academically, socially, and emotionally. And working together as adults and brainstorming those ideas is one sure way to help make that more successful.
Sure. You touched on a lot of good points there, Samantha. Using the teachers as a resource, not only have they had the students before, but they also, you know, a lot of the teachers, I had only been teaching at St. Bernadette for 4 years when I switched positions, but, you know, a four-year teacher does not have all the answers, and just like on the flip side, a 30-year teacher does not have all the answers. There are a lot of gaps that are missing, and different teachers bring different skill sets to the table and a different level of creativity. You're sitting next to two people who are on opposite sides of the creative spectrum. Samantha being on the very creative side and myself being on the not so creative side. So it's all, and I can tell you firsthand, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, that even before Samantha worked at the school with me, she would come down and help me set up my classroom before the year began. Because she had the ideas and she knew, she had the vision of what the classroom should look like and how to make it look brighter and more exciting as far as bulletin boards and setting up stuff on the walls and how to arrange the desks. So I took a lot from her. Point being, use your colleagues. They're there for a reason. And, you know, a lot of them probably haven't been reached out to and asked for their opinion. So they take it, they take a lot of pride in their profession, just like all of us do. So it means a lot to them, probably, when they're sought after for advice, especially from a younger teacher. It shows that they're willing to learn, and it shows that they still have that respect for their elders, and they appreciate their professional opinion.
Michael, you bring up a good point, too, about how someone who's been teaching for 4 years doesn't have all the answers, let alone someone who's teaching for 30, and I think sometimes there's this stigma, like, we must know all, we're the teacher, we must mm-hmm. solve this problem, where I think it's important to be said that there's no shame in not knowing and utilizing the people in your building to help you get to that answer. You know, you'll have kids that have some severe social needs and emotional disturbances in their life that are causing them to act a certain way or feel a certain way. And unless you're a counselor or a social worker, you might not have that tool set. That's why there's so many different people in a school to help it run successfully, that there's no shame in saying, oh, you know what, I don't know the answer to this, and working together to figure it out and to learn and to continue to learn no matter what the problem might be.
Right you are, Samantha. What do they say? They say I think one of the first things I learned at college as far in the education department was to beg, borrow, and steal. Have you heard that expression before, Samantha?
Yeah, don't recreate the wheel.
Yeah, it's all out there. Beg people for it, borrow their materials, or you know what? Just take their idea and make it your own. Or you just take their idea and do the exact same thing, but if people ask, you can say, oh, I got it from this person or that person.
Right, and every teacher has their own spin on what makes them effective and what helps them get through to the students. So, you know, taking that idea and making it your own is only going to help your students and the needs of the kids that you have in your class. One activity, and those of us that have been teaching for many years and have a project or a unit that we love, it never goes the same year to year. It's always a completely different experience for the teacher and for the students, because it's not just a cookie cutter or a formula you can follow.
Right.
You have 20 or 30 different personalities that are influencing the discussions that are happening or the learning that's taking place.
Now, we're getting into a whole nother topic here on the art of teaching versus the science of teaching, but we're going to save that for another time. Before we wrap up, last words on starting the year off. Samantha had mentioned procedures and how is your classroom structured, and that is everything. We want to jump into the curriculum and we think, oh my goodness, I'm not going to have enough time to get through this. Well, if you skip over the procedural points of those first 2 weeks of school, you're going to lose so much extra time correcting behaviors along the way. So your best bet is to spend a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, as long as you need to make sure that class is a well-oiled machine, knows how your classroom is to be ran most effectively, because you're the professional in that classroom, so you know better than they do on what they need to succeed. So spend as much time as you need in those first weeks of school getting them prepared so the maximum learning can occur afterwards.
And I think too, just having your goals clear. I mean, I know for me, my goal is that I cannot be there. My kids can run the classroom without me.
Sure.
They know what's going on. They know how to handle the problems. They know the routines. So take your end goal and then work backwards from it. What steps need to be taken to make that successful? What is your responsibility? What's the responsibility of the kids or the materials? How should things be treated? So just having that very clear list of things that you want to accomplish in order to make that end goal come to life.
Come to life. Hear, hear. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. We will be back again, I don't know, sometime soon. We'll say soon. Thanks for tuning in. We are Samantha and Michael Pryor. And you are listening to Prioritizing, P-R-Y-O-R, Pryor is our last name.
Thank you for listening.
Sure, thanks for listening. God bless, happy Easter.